Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Hello. Good day, everybody. My name is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of Omfit, and it's a great pleasure today to be talking to a veteran of development finance who's been looking at the issues of world development now for 30 years or more in a very, very practical way, very hands-on way. He's Jing Donghua, the legendary treasurer of the World Bank. And he's stepping down now at a very young age, of course, to take some kind of retirement. I'm sure it won't be a very passive retirement. I'm sure he'll be doing lots and lots of very interesting things during this time. I'm here to talk to you, Jing Dong, about your career, more than 30 years at the helm of development finance, working in all kinds of organizations, practically every single organization you could think of, starting with the African Development Bank. Tell us, Jing Dong, just in advance of your stepping down, how did it all start?
David, it's such a delight to have the opportunity to share some of my thoughts with you before my retirement. I may look young, but I started working in 1983. Of course, nothing compared with your legendary career, but it has been a long time. So I think it's quite a blessing to be able to retire and pursue other interests. But indeed, if I may say, my first job was a chemical engineer in China. And so while I was doing my chemical engineering, China started to open up. And there were quite a number of industrialization projects that China started to implement. I was very fortunate in the mid-1980s to work on one project financed by a entity called the Asian Development Bank. So I had a chance to visit Manila and got interested. I said, wow, there are organizations like the ADB. I like to work in such organizations. So that actually planted the seed. And then I quit my job in China, came to the US, had my MBA, then sent out three letters of application. One to the World Bank, one to the Asian Development Bank, and one to the African Development Bank. And mind you, back then, it was snail mail. There was no email per se. And somehow, I didn't hear from the Asian Development Bank or the World Bank. But I did get an invitation from the African Development Bank to join their Young Professionals Program. And that's how it all started. I started in Abidjan in my international career.
You've had a good look at these organizations from the inside. You've always made a big effort at propelling young professionals to the top. You've been developing people over that period of time. And the story you've told shows us how passionate you are about that. But you've also been in charge of the World Bank Treasury team now in these last two or three years, a time of great stress because of the pandemic, when many of the worst hit countries are getting even further behind. What have been the essential points that you've learnt during that time at the World Bank, during this very stressful period for world finance?
Indeed, David, the past 3 years have been fascinating and very enlightening. But before I answer that, let me also say that my treasury career actually started at random because I wanted to join the African Development Bank as an industrial engineer, a chemical engineer, building fertilizer factories in Nigeria, tire factories in Zambia. But the head of the interview panel was a treasurer of the African Development Bank. Somehow he liked me. He said, why don't you come here and work in treasury? And then one day I ended up as a treasurer of the World Bank. So that's a random journey, but I have loved every minute of it. But the 3 years in the World Bank Treasury certainly coincided with the global pandemic, which truly is unprecedented because, you know, since the World War II, in a very broad picture, we have been making progress on, you know, reducing poverty, generally speaking, the world economy growing. But the pandemic actually is the first time, instead of being progressive, we have come to a regressive situation where, in a synchronized manner, many countries went into recession and economic slowdown, and the devastation hit the developing countries and poorer countries much harder. Also, what I observed is that OECD countries, of course, every government has to take care of its own citizens first. They have a toolkit to come up with monetary and fiscal policy to stimulate the economy. But the poor developing countries had no such resources. Therefore, the World Bank played a very prominent role in terms of coming up with not only financial assistance, but also advisory services in terms of how do we focus on saving lives, help the most vulnerable, and of course, long-term supporting countries with a resilient, inclusive, and green recovery. So the World Bank actually deploys the largest crisis help package, $157 billion across the bank group for our developing countries in 18 months. This is truly unprecedented. I think it is really in crisis, the goal or the role of multilateralism shines through. Now, in World Bank Treasury, we were able to mobilize global savings, and we issued some of our largest single bonds. For example, May 2020, at the early stage of the pandemic, we issued the single largest dollar bond outside of U.S. Treasury, $8 billion, in terms of mobilizing resources to fight COVID-19. So certainly sitting as a treasurer of the World Bank, being able to help that, I think it was an extraordinary experience.
Raising the money is, of course, extremely important. Now, it's become a cliche to say that we have trillions of savings from large institutions being put into very low-yielding or some of the negatively yielding government bonds. In future, to meet the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030, that is all of our hopes and our ambition, we're going to need a tremendous amount of private capital, not just the World Bank and other official organizations. What are your two or three precepts from a long career in leveraging the private capital, get that insight to crowd in that finance? I know this is a never-ending story, but what are the two or three things that we really need to do to leverage the private sector? Because without that, we will not succeed.
Yeah, David, that is the perennial question, and I think we're getting closer to the answers. Well, the first thing I wanted to say, the multilateral development banks itself is such a catalytical institution. Just to give you an example, IBRD, which is the World Bank, you know, we are a bank. We have equity capital from our shareholders. And over the past 76 years, they have given us around $20, $25 billion paid in capital. Now, leveraging that capital, how much have we done? We have issued over $1 trillion of bonds, of which 80%, over $800 billion, became direct development finance resources. So that's truly from billions to trillions, right? So how do we leverage better the multilateral development banks to risk transform world savings into development finance? I think that's one step. I certainly would wish the World Bank, African Bank, ADB, AIIB are given much more equity capital, because the way we can leverage to scale up is fantastic. That's the first thing. The second thing is that through climate angle, I think people realize that problems don't stop at national borders. If we don't solve global challenges, I think everybody would suffer the consequences. Therefore, even private capital realizes that doing well and doing good can go hand in hand. Now, there, I think we are addressing a couple of issues. One is the risk perception. That is, in actuality, especially in my work at the IFC, we found, because IFC invests solely in developing countries in a private sector manner, right, in a commercial manner. But if you do investment in developing countries in a diversified manner, and if you're a patient capital, you end up making a decent return that is comparable to OECD private investment return. So what it means is that there is a gap between risk reality and risk perception. For a typical investor coming from OECD country, the risk perception is much higher than the actual risk.
So how do you bridge the gap? I know these things are not simple, but it seems to be partly a communication problem. How do we get over that?
Yeah, indeed. There are two things that we can do. One is that multilateral development banks, including the IC and the private sector arm of all the other development banks, need to put mobilization much more center in our strategy. So every dollar we invest becomes a skin in the game to crowd in much more private sector. I think IC has done a lot in that area, but more can be done. At the same time, I think the private sector investors themselves are realizing that they need to become more risk tolerant, in the sense that how do we bind our resources together in a portfolio approach to diversify the idiosyncratic risk away and benefit from the general rise in the economic prosperity of the world, right? That is a long game. So it's about long-term investment rather than making a short-term alpha. So that mindset change for private sector, I think, is coming. As a matter of fact, I have been very fortunate to be invited to the G7 Impact Investment Task Force, where a report was just released this week. And I think it's worth everybody reading it, from transparency to standardize a reporting so that we all have a baseline of what are we investing in.
But also you do need the, as well as these reports, Jing Dong, you do need the missionary people, people like yourself who've got some energy and some fire and some ambition and some real communication skills. There's no point just producing these reports. People have to read them, don't they? How do we actually get the message across, say, to the World Pension Funds, to the people who are obviously relatively staid, relatively conservative? There's a herd instinct here that maybe needs to be overcome. Reports are one thing, but then driving people to read them and to act on them is something else. How do we do that?
Well, indeed, David, this report is called Time to Deliver, Mobilize and Private Capital at Scale for People and Planet. If you look at the 120 people on the on this committee, you will see they are investors, they are asset owners, they are from multilateral development banks, they are governments. I think it is worth reading the commitment and the concrete ways in terms of what can be done. I think I would say this report is different than past reports, and hopefully through a and the advice is very specific. Here's what you can do as a government. Here's what you can do as multilateral development bank. Here are the things you need to do as asset owners. Here are the things you can do as institutional investors. So I certainly hope this one will make a difference.
Well, I certainly hope so too. And after all, you've got 120 people here. They are all genuine ambassadors. Now, we've got climate change, which is now a real political element in world politics, which it wasn't up until the change of administration in the United States. How secure are you in thinking that the agenda of countering climate change will now go up a notch, not just in terms of headlines in newspapers, but also in terms of the real active policies of world investors, private and public? Is this irreversible now, do you think, Jing Dong?
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly think so. As a World Bank group, we are definitely stepping up our climate change commitment. And now I think we are saying that you know, more than a third of our direct investment would have a climate call benefit. And certainly there are instruments that we can use to scale up the intervention. One thing I wanted to mention, David, which is small, but I think has huge, huge potential, is catastrophe bonds. You know, recently we issued a catastrophe bond for Jamaica, protecting the country for three seasons of hurricane. Now, what's the difference between a cat bond versus a regular natural disaster insurance. And allow me a couple of minutes, because I think this has huge potential. David, let me say that you're a finance minister of a country, and you call the infra minister and you say, hey, I have $100 million for you to build bridges and roads, but then an earthquake or hurricane happens, and you call him again. You say that 100 million is gone because we have humanitarian crisis because of the natural disaster. Here comes a cat bond, which provides that $100 million cover. What the government can do is just to pay the insurance premium, where the risk is now being borne by the private investors. Now, the beautiful thing about this Jamaica cat bond is that the risk premium is actually shouldered by USAID and the Global Trust Fund, right? Now, using a small bilateral donation to catalyze 182 million protection for the government, where the government doesn't have to use its very limited fiscal space to do, is fantastic. Now, the other beauty of this is that because this is parametric, that is, once it is a named hurricane, reach certain degree, the payout is automatic, rather than an indemnity insurance where it will take a year or two before you assess the damage and then payout happens. So we have done 5-6 billion of cat bond, but I think this itself could scale up to 100 billion, 200 billion. Why? Because investors love this instrument. It diversifies away from the regular fixed income. It offers a higher coupon because of the insurance premium. And I think this is one way that we can push for scaling up climate financing among many other different solutions.
Well, you're right. And there's an essential reliability in the whole methodology, isn't there, which would appeal to the shall we say, the more actuarial amongst the asset managers. Can you apply that principle also of impact to much bigger sections of the world bond market? We're talking about green bonds. There's the whole GSS segment now, isn't there, which is growing greatly in significance and in attractiveness. You have been a great issuer at the World Bank of these green bonds, but it now seems to be spreading out beyond the pure green dimension. Can you tell us about how the GSS section has actually developed, and what are your hopes for the future there?
Absolutely, David. And indeed, the World Bank over a decade ago issued the first labeled green bond. At that time, green bond was a niche product, and we had some Swedish investors interested in social responsibilities. And since that bond, the green bond market is now over $1 trillion, and that's only a decade. So this really gives me the confidence. However, I think what we have done in the past couple of years is to transit from a specific issue to what we call a whole balance sheet approach. That is, it's not about just a single issue. It's about how you as a company address the sustainability impact in everything you do. And certainly the World Bank, given its mission, everything we do is intended to bring a positive impact. And therefore, we have broadbanded our bond program into sustainable development bonds. And through that label, we address so many different issues. And here, another example that is about food loss and waste, which even I didn't know is such a global issue. I went to Japan to sell a food loss bond for the World Bank. And when I said, look, due to food loss and waste, it actually is the third largest source of carbon emission after energy and transport, right? It wastes 20% of the freshwater resources. I mean, this is really a very, very big issue. And we raised billions of dollars through this awareness campaign. And therefore, of course, we have done COVID bond. We have done bond addressing gender equality, ocean pollution, so on and so forth. Then what we do is that we issue an impact report and highlighting to investors through our program Although it's not one-to-one, but generally through our whole balance sheet approach, here are the impact we have made through our investment in developing countries. And I certainly hope every company would take the same approach. And through this impact report, one of the strong recommendations is for the IFRS, ISSB, to come up with a global baseline on sustainability impact reporting, hopefully, and of course, build on that to do even better. You know, through that collective effort, hopefully we will get many multinational companies to get on the bandwagon also.
Yes, this ISSB, the International Sustainability Standards Board, is just going to be set up now in the next few months with a base in Frankfurt, but with hubs all over the world, OMFIF will be getting involved in that. Everything that you said, Jingdong, leads me to believe that financial engineers and financial innovators out there who may be listening to you and who know you already, they should apply to the World Bank and they should apply to other multinational development organizations, because from what you're saying, you are at the firefighting front of knowledge and innovation. What is your message, particularly to young people? Because I know you do a lot of outreach work with universities. If you're talking to them here directly here in this video cast, what is your message to them regarding joining the World Bank and other similar organizations?
David, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to say something to this effect to young people who are interested in finance and using finance to do good. You can always work on Wall Street or the city, but I think for those of you who want both financial innovation and use your skills, but also to help humanity, I think the treasuries of multilateral banks, especially the World Bank, is a place to be. You know, when I was in IC, I hired over 50 young people onto the treasury team. And in the World Bank treasury, in the past 3 years, and we haven't finished that journey, we are hiring close to 100 young people into our team. And we created an internship program so that even undergraduate students who are interested in exploring can come to work a summer at the World Bank treasury. And then if they are great, we offer them a 2-year job before they go to graduate school, and hopefully they will become lifelong development finance professionals. Just to give you an example, last year we issued a very interesting bond and using our AAA name to raise private financing for UNICEF. And the UNICEF portion is collateralized by the private donation to UNICEF. How cool is that, right? So the UNICEF can use front loading to address a devastating effect on children because of COVID-19. Now, this same train of thought as CAD bond, as a UNICEF bond, can be applied very broadly so that ODA money, which is official development assistance money, which is limited, can be used much more as catalyst. Just like USAID going to Jamaica premium, that is ODA money through a World Bank bond called capital risk, they will come in only to pay for success of the endeavor. If it is a failure, we pass the risk to private bond investor so that the ODA money can be used for successes. And we are in the process of applying that to many different solutions. And let me mention one more thing, that is digital currency. The World Bank issued the world's first blockchain bond, and we are working once digital central bank currency comes into being. This will again disrupt how we can do fundraising, hopefully through global retail bonds.
Well, I think we're just at the beginning of many of these innovations. Just in the final minutes that we've got left, I wanted to mention one innovation that you pioneered at the IFC. That is the famous MCPP program, the co-investment program under which you securitize part of the loans that the IFC has made, and you bring in large pension funds, large insurance companies, central banks even, the central bank of the People's Bank of China. Can you use that kind of instrument in the future also to crowd in some of this finance from outside? Can you just give us a few brief visionary words on extending PC, the MCPP type programs?
Absolutely, David. I think, you know, I'm very grateful that central banks, including Chinese Central Bank, Hong Kong Monetary Authority, others are coming in. But more importantly, we have global insurance company and global institution investor that joined the MCPP program, right? Which means that when you design a product that makes sense with diversification, with patient capital, with a track record that can assure investors there is alpha or return that you can have. Now, what is exciting is that when you combine that with blockchain, with AI, with fintech, we probably can offer this through a retail bond platform to global millennials and Generation X and Z. So I give you one example, right? Let's say we do MCPP or MCPP-like instrument and sell it to very passionate next generation. And we say that, okay, one bond is $100 or equivalent in any currency, but you are doing good things for the world. I'm sure we're going to get 1 billion young people to come in.
I'm sure you're right? Absolutely right. I mean, this gives me a few ideas for the future, Jing Gong.
And that's $100 billion.
Yes.
And regulators would be fine because they know through AI, machine learning, blockchain, we will take care of the AML, KYC, and CFT issue. So, you know, it's so exciting. I'm already regretting I'm retiring, but I think...
You're not going to retire. That's something we are all clear about. Just one last thing. One of your great visions has been the development of local capital markets in what is practically your birthplace of Africa. That's been one of the areas where you want to drive on. That's certainly not finished yet. What are the lessons that you've learned, and what are the words of wisdom you can offer to, say, African finance ministers, African central bankers who may be listening, watching this, because driving on the local development of the local currency markets, that may not do everything. It may not be the final way of solving everybody's problems, but it's certainly a very big stepping stone. What are your two or three brief words on that, please, Jing Dong?
Yeah, David, when we observe those countries who have succeeded in traveling that economic prosperity journey, capital market or financial market is a critical element in it. Without a deep, liquid, vibrant domestic financial system and capital market, a country would not be able to efficiently grow, recycle its domestic savings as a primary source to finance its economic growth. And leave the country vulnerable to debt sustainability issues when you rely on a foreign currency. And therefore, developing local capital market is not a luxury, it's a necessity.
And then in these minutes that we've been talking, it's quite clear you're not going to retire. This is a word that I don't think really exists in your vocabulary, but you're going to be doing something else. Can you let us know what you intend to do? I'm sure you're not going to be lost to the world of development financing. In fact, I'm going to make sure you are not lost, because your vision and your encouraging words and your communicative skills are very badly needed. But what are your plans, apart from listening to a bit of Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky, and maybe even playing it together with your children?
Well, David, thank you. Certainly, I will take a little bit of time off. But I think there are a couple of things I will continue to be a passionate advocate for. So first, it's about multilateralism. And I certainly believe, especially when crisis happens, the only solution is through multilateralism, where shareholders or a global community come together, rally together, and provide solution that brings consensus to the community. So I will be a strong advocate. I have been, spending my last three decades as a Bretton Woods kid, and I will forever be a Bretton Woods kid or multilateral kid. So that's one thing. The second thing is local capital market development. I think that's an area where I have done a lot of practice, including issuing many of the inaugural bonds in local currency, and certainly an area I will continue to be a strong voice. Another thing I wanted to spend time is Africa. As you said, that I started my career in Africa, I think Africa has tremendous opportunities with a young generation. And I think we as humanity, if we don't through our collective effort, make sure Africa gets ahead and be successful as other continent, we then fail as a humanity together. So I will do my little part in terms of contributing to Africa rising. The fourth area is financial technology, fintech. And I think that through the powerful example of M-Pesa, David, you and I were in Nairobi, and we saw the incredible power of M-Pesa, given Kenyans the ability to gain financial services from below 10% before M-Pesa to over 90% after M-Pesa through financial technology. How can we accelerate, you know, financial inclusion through fintech? I think that's an area I have a lot of passion on. So there are many other things, but let me just mention four, which should indeed keep me very busy and probably my wife not so happy in the future.
Well, perhaps we'll make sure your wife doesn't listen to this, but you'll obviously, I'm sure you'll have a very happy time while you reflect on what you're going to be doing. And I think you will be spreading your wings now. You've taken more than 30 years to get to where you are. You're not going to give it up. You've done your bureaucracy. You've done your time at technocratic institutions. You've shown that you can organize things. I think it is now time to move out even further and to use this famous outreach that you have, your friends everywhere in the world. And I think a lot of what you said makes tremendous sense. And there's all kinds of people out there who wants to team up with you in a different framework compared with what you've had up to now. I think you've got a huge amount of liberty now to do these things with governments and institutions, both public and private, all over the world. So let me simply wish you well for the time of reflection while you do work out exactly what it is that you want to do. I'm sure there'll be all kinds of offers and interesting engagements which will be flooding in. You'll have to look at all that and decide, sort it all out. And then maybe in about 6 months, you'll have a portfolio of different things. And I very much hope that this will be for the good of not just Africa, but world development institutions everywhere. So I really would like everybody who's been listening to this to give a big virtual hand of applause to Jing Dong Hua, chemical engineer turned financial engineer turned human engineer. Thank you very much for talking to us, and we look forward very much to engaging you further in the future, Jing Dong.
David, thank you so much. Let me also say that I have been associated with ONFIF almost since your inception. And David, through your vision, your leadership, you have brought so many intellectuals and decision maker, policy makers together to discuss not only just intellectual discussion, but to work on real solutions. And the work you do in promoting capital market development in Africa, among many other things, is a great way that you are making contribution. So if there is a way that I can be a junior a consultant to you, David, one day I would be honored to do so. But let me give you a big thanks for the great work that you do. I'm sure our paths will cross very soon. And I wish everybody who listening in a very happy holiday seasons.
Well, that's very kind of you. And thank you very much reciprocated on our side as well. We're always looking for younger people as well, also at ONFIF, not just the aged individuals. So anybody listening to this, please do apply to us as well as to the World Bank, because we really do want to bring on these young innovators as well. So let's have no more mutual adoration, Jing Dong. Look forward to a good rest for you over the holiday. You're leaving, and Jorge Familiar will be taking over from you on the 31st of December. But I'm sure you'll have a bit of a time off between Christmas and the New Year and afterwards. And then look forward to a very fruitful period of reflection, and look forward to talking to you again to develop our friendship further in 2022, and hopefully to do some even more action together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This is David Marsh signing off. I hope you've had a good time listening to Jing Dong Hua, and I join everybody in wishing him very well for the future. Thank you very much, Jing Dong, for talking to us. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the ONFIF podcast.